From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Higher education wonders about the next 2 years following the Tuesday elections, and competency-based programs move towards the center as four major public universities launch new competency-based degree programs. Hi, this is Casey Green. I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So, welcome all. And ahead of our conversation, please note you can post your thoughts about these conversations on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. In our opening segment today, we will talk about higher education after the election. Republicans pretty much ran the table on Tuesday's midterm elections, winning almost all of the most highly contested Senate and many of the competitive gubernatorial races. Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, a former governor, university president, and the former Secretary of Education under the first President Bush, now seems poised to assume the chair of the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, which will preside over all federal higher education legislation for the next 2 years, including the reauthorization of the Higher Education Act, as well as financial aid issues, plus any legislation involving several signature issues of the Obama administration, including efforts to create a rating system for colleges and universities, and potentially gainful employment regulations targeting for-profit colleges and universities. At the state level, the results for higher education were mixed. The elections retained some governors often viewed as unfriendly to higher education, Republicans Rick Scott in Florida, Scott Walker in Wisconsin, and replaced one deemed hostile, Republican Tom Corbett in Pennsylvania. Yet voters also reelected others generally seen as supporting higher education in their states, Democrats Jerry Brown in California, Andrew Cuomo in New York, Daniel Malloy in Connecticut, and Republican Bill Haslam in Tennessee, who wants to eliminate tuition for students who attend community colleges. Joining us for this after-election conversation are Daniel Hurley, Associate Vice President for Governmental Relations and State Policy at ASCU, the American Association of State Colleges and Universities. Christopher Loss is an Associate Professor of Public Policy and Higher Education at Vanderbilt University. And Scott Jasek is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Dan Hurley in Washington, let me begin with you. My guess is you and your colleagues at the various Washington associations that represent the constituencies for higher education had some very interesting early morning conversations the day after the election. What can you tell us?
Well, some of it was a bit anticipated, given the forecasting of the potential change in Senate leadership. And so I think we saw it coming, but certainly the results played out on election night. And so, yes, there is going to be a change of direction, I think, in federal policy, certainly as dictated by Congress. And as you mentioned, Senator Lamar Alexander has a different game plan for the Senate committee that oversees higher education, much different set of priorities than Senator Harkin had from Iowa. And so I think we are going to see a more of a focus, and I think in a positive direction for the higher ed community, a focus on deregulation, reducing the federal regulatory burden for higher ed institutions. He has talked about simplifying the financial aid application process, which would be very positive. But other issues that you mentioned, one is simply funding of federal financial aid, kind of, you know, all of Congress, the mood is going to be more conservative in terms of funding those domestic discretionary programs. And then also federal funding for academic research, I think, is going to gain a lot of scrutiny as well. And as you mentioned, where things stand on gainful employment regulations and the college ratings plan, I think, is also very much up in the air right now.
Scott Jasek, you're also based in Washington. Does Lamar Alexander become the big man in terms of high education and higher education for the next 2 years?
Well, he does, but actually, if I had to predict what the biggest impact and from Congress will be, I would say two things. One is just incredibly frugal budgets, perhaps more frugal than they would be if Lamar Alexander were running the show. The new team in the Senate and the old but now strengthened team in the House they just don't want to spend much on anything. And when you're in a hostile environment for all spending, higher ed really gets hit because it's not protected in the way that some parts of the budget are. And then just building on what Dan said at the end there, I think for-profit higher education is probably pretty happy with the election results. I think Gainful, maybe in addition to being challenged in the courts, maybe challenged in Congress. I think the idea of using congressional committee to draw scrutiny on for-profit is probably over. So I think those will be the two most dramatic changes.
And Christopher Loss at Vanderbilt, you're at a distance, some might say a safe distance from Washington, as you survey the landscape the morning after the election, several days after the election. What do the prospects look like for the next 2 years in terms of higher education policy, funding, planning from the federal level?
Well, I think that Senator Alexander will be faced with a number of pretty significant challenges. Clearly, the budget hawks in the House and in the Senate looking to really slash funding, especially for higher education. I think that's certainly a really big issue. And then again, I think there's a big issue around one of his biggest claims, which has been to deregulate aspects of higher education, from student aid to the onerous regulatory mechanisms in place governing all aspects of higher education. There's been a lot of talk about deregulation, a lot of talk around the Higher Education Act around starting from scratch. And I think the question is, how plausible is it to really deregulate an economy that is so deeply entwined with the federal, state, and local government? And then I think the big question around starting from scratch is how likely is it on the Higher Education Act to really be able to reboot an entire piece of omnibus legislation that has been reauthorized 9 times, is up for reauthorization, and exceeds well over 1,000 pages in its last iteration. So these are big questions.
Let's touch on the Higher Education Act for a moment, Dan Hurley. 9 times reauthorized since 1965. This is a big document with lots of different touch points for higher education. The biggest part, obviously, student financial aid, but includes developing institutions, graduate education, and lots of other issues. Senator Alexander has said that he wants to simplify. As Chris said, I mean, is it really possible to start from scratch with that large piece and that significant a piece of legislation?
I think that there's a good intention to try to start from scratch and start anew. I think a lot of people support that, but politically, I just think I concur with Chris's sentiments that I don't think it's the passage is overall realistic. And I think, there'll be a focus next year in 2015 on the Higher Education Act, because it's due up for a reauthorization. It's also the 50th anniversary of that landmark piece of legislation. But I just don't see it as a priority for Senator Alexander. One, as Scott mentioned, was just the whole focus on Congress on the budgetary side of things across the federal budget. And also, we have to look just politically at the short policy window. We really have about 15 months for Congress to pass any type of legislation before they go into freeze mode heading into spring of 2016 with the presidential elections. We've already seen this Congress being one of the least productive historically now that we have both chambers and the opposition party to the president. I don't see a whole lot of significant legislation passing. The last thing I would say is that Senator Alexander has placed priority on passage of ESEA, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, as a priority to HEA. So I think the focus will be more on K-12 federal policy.
Scott, let me come to the issue of simplify. Senator Alexander has said he wants to simplify FAFSA, simplify the Higher Education Act. Turning to FAFSA, we heard Mrs. Spellings in the wake of the 2006 Spellings Commission say that she wanted to simplify FAFSA and turn it into a one-page document. How easy will it be, or how big is the challenge in terms of simplifying, whether it's FAFSA or regulations or some of these other things that are on his target list?
Well, nobody is anti-simplification, but it just gets more complicated than people expect. Everyone wants it to be really easy to fill out. At the same time, if they go in an extreme and make it super easy to fill out, you can predict with a lot of confidence that a year from now there'll be some scandal as people are somehow gaming the system in an inappropriate way, and people will say, why did Congress end all the controls? The other thing about regulation is in a reauthorization, you historically have a lot of members of Congress, and I don't think this is a Democratic thing or a Republican thing, who use it to tack on something. So I'm not talking about like Pell Grants or a major loan program, but people will say anyone who receives Pell Grants or receives federal funds must do X or must report on Y. And that all adds up to a lot of regulation, but at the moment that those things are being adopted, they typically reflect hot political issues. And whether Senator Alexander can shut that down on members of his own party in addition to Democrats remains to be seen.
I want to touch on one other federal issue before we move to the states, and that's the issue of funding for scientific research. Money is tight. You've all mentioned that. It's going to be a real challenge to get any increase in money. But the question beyond the money becomes the question about which science. There's been some pushback on the parts of various groups representing various parts of the Republican Party about funding different parts of the science establishment, not so much the physics and chemistry, but some of the social sciences, some of the other issues. Are we going to see this as part of the a contentious conversation as bills come to the Congress for support for the National Science Foundation and other agencies? Dan, let me begin with you on that. Not money for science, but money for which sciences?
Correct. I think that will be debated, and I think we'll see some rhetorical flashpoints from specific members of Congress. But I think when it's all said and done, I don't see particularly lower levels for one type of lower levels of funding for one science over another.
Okay, Scott, issues about science or other things we need to watch in the new Congress?
Well, I do think that there are a number of senators, typically Republicans, who love to pick on the social sciences or biological or public health work that deals with some hot button social issues that they disapprove of. And with Republicans in control of the Senate, those voices are likely to be louder than they would be in a Democrat Senate.
Okay, great. Let's go to the states. The results, depending on how you score this, were mixed. We saw some Republican governors who had been perceived as being hostile being reelected. We saw other governors, primarily Democratic, but not exclusively, also return to office. What's the landscape look like for the states for the next 2 years? Dan Hurley, again, ask you as a state college association, let me begin this conversation about the states with you.
Sure. Well, certainly the big takeaway was Republican continued Republican gains for the third election cycle. We have gubernatorial pickups, state legislative chamber pickups. We now have more Republican legislative chambers at the state level since the most since 1928. I think the big surprise was the gubernatorial pickups in traditionally blue states, Illinois, Massachusetts, Maryland. That was a big surprise. Higher ed was not particularly high on the priority list on the campaign trail, probably a 4, 5, or 6 type of issue. It was highly debated in Georgia and in Florida. And as you said, you know, one message was that, you know, you can, as a governor, cut higher ed significantly in some cases, such as Florida, Wisconsin, Maine, and still get reelected. But I do think in the broader scope of things, there were a lot of other, obviously, factors at play in the elections. But I think that I'm actually, just because we have a huge sweep of Republicans, a lot of that are conservative, I'm not necessarily pessimistic about state support of higher ed in the next couple of years. I think it has to do more with economic and state revenue conditions. And I think for most states in that case, it's an optimistic outlook, and generally the trend is higher ed gets cuts more disproportionately during economic downturns, but benefits more broadly in upturns. So I think while state spending for higher ed might be a little bit lower than under Democratic leadership at the state level, I still think that it's going to be more positive than negative in the next couple of years.
Chris Loss, while higher ed may not have been a high issue, certainly there was a lot of conversation about college costs, and since most students go to public institutions, that's really a state issue. We've seen state cuts have resulted in higher tuition costs for students. In some states, the state contribution to operating costs at the state universities are down under 10%. In Colorado, I believe it's about 5%. As you look at the landscape, what do you see for the next couple of years?
Yeah, I'm probably not quite as optimistic in terms of funding for state higher at the state higher education level. I think that we're still not at pre-recession levels in terms of state funding. It still lags, and I think that the big question in this new post-election climate, where you've got 32 governors that are in the hands of gubernatorial offices in the hands of Republicans, and then you have something like 29 legislatures are completely Republican. I think the inclination there, especially against the onset of the Affordable Care Act and some of the other supposedly big ticket federal items over the last couple of years, I think there's going to be a strong inclination to cut taxes, which does raise a significant revenue question at the state level. And I think that, compounded with potential budget hawk activity at the federal level, I think that money does become a real issue.
Let me give you each a chance to sort of give us a closing comment. What should we be watching for the next 2 years, and who should we be watching for the next 2 years? Dan Hurley?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of focus is going to be at the federal level. The switch over to Republicans' hands in the Senate and chair leadership by Senator Alexander does put a lot of different things in play, so I think a lot of focus is going to be at the federal level. And certainly a lot of focus on college affordability, college access, and I would also say that accountability certainly will be a theme. There may be a focus at the federal level to decrease the federal regulatory burden, but accountability for higher ed on the part of federal lawmakers and state lawmakers will continue to be a theme.
Chris Loss, who should we be watching and what should we be watching for the next 24 months?
Well, I think we should certainly be watching the new leadership at the federal level, Senator Alexander, of course, John Klein on the House side from Minnesota. And I think the big issues are reauthorization, ratings, regulation. And I think it's also important to remember that while we focused on higher education during our conversation here, it's also important to remember that there's a whole backlog of education-related public policy that's in the pipeline that is waiting reauthorization, from ed research to child care to workforce, K-12, and reauthorization of ESEA and special education. So there's a lot to be done, and I think the big question is, can this next Congress be somewhat more productive than one of the least productive Congresses in the history of the institution?
Scott Jasek, you get the last word. You're constantly watching as a journalist. So what will you be watching, and who will you be watching from the perspective of Inside Higher Ed?
I actually think the states are going to have more of an influence on the federal government in the next 2 years. I'm very curious to see if the state legislatures that have gone Republican do pass tax increases, or tax cuts, rather, that will lead to spending cuts in many public higher education budgets. I think the fact that many of the governors elected ran on anti-tax, anti-spending platforms could get quite complicated for some college leaders.
Great. Dan Hurley, Christopher Law, Scott Jasek, thank you for your time and for this conversation. In our second segment today, we talk about how competency is moving to the center. Competency-based programs at Capella University, Southern New Hampshire University, and Western Governors University have been, to date, outliers in the larger universe of conventional credit-driven courses and programs in American higher education. But the outlier status of competency-based programs may be changing quickly, as four major public universities, Purdue, Michigan, Texas, and Wisconsin, are now developing competency-based programs. These new initiatives often target adult learners eager to complete degrees or working professionals who want and need additional certification. These new programs seem designed to supplement, not supplant, current offerings. Moreover, rather than undertake an incremental adjustment to current programs to make them competency-based, these new initiatives at Michigan, Purdue, Texas, and Wisconsin also appear to reflect a new approach to designing the learning experience, delivering instructional content, and assessing student performance. Yet for many observers, questions remain about student learning, the student experience, and student outcomes based on competency and not credits. Joining us for this conversation are Aaron Brower. He is the interim chancellor of the UW Colleges and UW Extension for the University of Wisconsin. Mike Offerman is president emeritus of Capella University and currently an independent consultant. And Scott Jasek is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. So Scott Jasek at Inside Higher Ed, let me begin with you. Give us a common foundation to understand the difference between credits and competencies as we go forward.
Sure. So, I mean, the basic credit model that has been used is to earn a degree, you need to get X number of credits, which you get by completing Y number of courses. You are in those courses for a semester, you pass, and it all adds up. In the competency model, you might take no courses at all. You are somehow demonstrating the knowledge or skills behind a degree, and it might be very speedy, it might not. The role of the professor is in some ways as much a coach as a lecturer or instructor. And I think what's really key is what you alluded to at the end. Right now, competency has been around for a while with institutions like SNHU and Capella and WGU. People are really taking note, though, when you have Wisconsin, Texas, Michigan, Purdue. I've just noticed when I'm at conferences with lots of academics, when you talk about competency and say Michigan and Wisconsin are doing it, you get a lot of buzz and people want to know what's going on. A lot of people in academia wait till the big guys do it to take something seriously.
So, Aaron Brower, you're one of the big guys. Wisconsin is one of the four major publics that's moved into competency education, competency-based programs. Some might argue that the movement of Wisconsin and others brings a new credibility to this. Why competency programs and why now at Wisconsin and the other three major publics?
Right. So Wisconsin actually started down this road 3 years ago and opened our program with students starting their work about a year ago, and it's working just the way we hope it is. Students, just as Scott had mentioned, students working their way through quickly through some areas of the program and more slowly and diligently through other areas. Why now? You know, the higher ed is changing in almost every way imaginable, and these kinds of programs really put student learning front and center. And for many students who need education to fit around their life rather than have their life fit around semester-by-semester systems, this really is a better way to go.
Mike Offerman, former president of Capella, does the arrival of Wisconsin and others bring a new credibility to the early efforts of Capella and others that were at the forefront of competency-based programs?
Well, I certainly would agree with Scott that it changes the discussion and it creates something of a buzz. But I will point out that, as Aaron said, Wisconsin has been at this now for 3 years and a year of offering it. And so the idea, and by the way, they're a charter member of an organization called the Competency-Based Education Network that's made up of about 20 organizations, institutions that are involved. But we also track schools that are getting into CBE and have over 200 schools out there that are at least at the planning stage, and about a half of those, or roughly 100, are into development and delivery mode. And they run the gamut and include state systems like Wisconsin, community colleges, regional public colleges, private, nonprofit, and for-profit. So the big deal in my mind with having Michigan, Purdue, and Texas come in is that it adds additional research-intensive schools, which is important because we don't have a rich research base, and I'm hoping we'll add to that. But it's important to have these schools, and I certainly think it does no harm, and it certainly does a lot of good to have those sorts of institutions with their well-deserved reputations engaging with us and figuring out what works and what does not work with competency-based higher education.
The role of the faculty in developing these programs seems to be a little different than it might be in other contexts. I mean, for example, if we look at the evolution of online programs, often these have been evolved absent the direct involvement of core faculty and key programs. Yet the initiatives, certainly at Wisconsin, Aaron, as you and I have talked, I suspect absolutely at Capella, Mike, as that evolved, very much were faculty-centric. Let's talk a bit about the role of faculty at the center of these programs. Mike, let me bring you in on that, as you were doing this first.
Well, I'm not sure I would agree as a generalization that online did not include core faculty, and I want to be careful that we not conflate online with competency-based. But that said, I certainly agree that Purdue, Michigan, Texas, Wisconsin, and Capella are involving faculty, but some of these other schools that I've talked about, and I think it's difficult for me to conceptualize not having the faculty intensely involved, because if you look at competency-based education, the reason it's such an attractive innovation that it goes to the very essence of what we do, more so certainly than online did. It gets at curriculum design and delivery, how we support the learner and how we assess their learning. So it's incredibly important that we engage the faculty, and they are essential in the definition of both formative and summative competencies and their assessment. There are emerging models where the faculty role may shift, focusing more, as we said earlier, on coaching or some really specializing in assessment. But the faculty are critical, and it's hard for me to imagine developing a competency-based education program that would not involve the faculty intensively.
Scott, you've been watching this landscape both in terms of online ed as well as competency ed. Do you see differences in terms of the role of faculty? What's your take on the faculty role in competency-based programs?
Well, Mike is correct that certainly you can find examples in online and competency where faculty have been deeply involved, although I'd say you can also find a lot of cases where the faculty of the traditional institution or whatever existed before online or competency were sort of walled off, and new groups were brought in to work on online, which generates a great deal of skepticism from those who were at the institution to start with. I was struck in talking to Aaron previously about the way the regular faculty of those University of Wisconsin campuses were, in fact, helping to define what is a degree, signify, and to teach. And I think if you look at the very substantial skepticism among traditional faculty members of online education, a lot of it, I think, is because they weren't centrally involved. So I am very intrigued by the model at Wisconsin and elsewhere of truly having a faculty role in the whole thing.
So Aaron, let's turn to you. Wisconsin has deep faculty involvement. The article in Inside Higher Ed this week talking about Texas and particularly the program launching in the medical sciences talked very much about faculty doing a ground-up redesign for competency-based programs. What's involved in terms of getting faculty engaged, getting faculty involved, getting faculty to look beyond credits to competency?
You know, the big change, well, so one of the things we're most proud of at in our Wisconsin model, and maybe this is, a new path as people are getting into this, into the direct assessment version of competency-based education, is that what we're really, our aspiration is that students are receiving the same degree, the actual degree from our UW institutions, using this different flex option route. So you start with the faculty with the same learning outcomes for the Bachelor's of Nursing degree, for example, at UW-Milwaukee, the same faculty, same learning outcomes, and the route to achieve that degree is this more flexible competency-based model. But the skills, the abilities, the oversight, the faculty, the academic planning and approval processes are the same ones that you need to validate that degree at UW-Milwaukee. And that's different than I think some of the programs that have developed, and Western Governors is really the forefather here. What they did, though, was create a new institution, and then they had new structures, new workload rules, new everything to create this model. And what we're trying to say here is that you can blend this with your current institution rather than have to create a parallel institution. And I think what it does is invigorate faculty to really think again about what they want their student learning outcomes to look like, rather than think about my course, what am I teaching in my course, what are my activities for my course.
Mike Offerman, Aaron Brower used the term oversight and validation. Beyond the actual campus activities, there's obviously the role of accrediting agencies and the federal government in terms of financial aid for these programs, both which potentially pose significant barriers in terms of affirmation, accreditation, and eligibility. Seems like the moving to competency poses some major challenges as institutions go forward. Again, Capella was involved with this early and often. What are some of the challenges with both accreditation and aid eligibility?
Well, first of all, let me just say that I think we all realize that federal financial aid eligibility is dependent upon accreditation, so they sort of come together, and all of the competency-based education programs need to be reviewed. Add to that that when you go into direct assessment, as Wisconsin and Capella have, you add another layer of review, which is following the accreditor's approval of a program. You then have to have a second review done by the Department of Education. So, looking across not only my experience at Capella, but working with schools that are into this, I would say this. I think the regional accrediting commissions are doing their best, but it's within a policy and rules environment that is somewhat opaque. And there is variance across the regions, but I think that's expected. My understanding is, though, that the regional accrediting bodies are now working on producing a common statement, which I think will be helpful. And of course, it's always challenging to get approvals from the accrediting commissions, but that's exactly what the public expects. So my experience in this is that getting approval from the commissions has been much more straightforward than going through the direct assessment process, which is brand new. The challenge we have here is this is new not only for faculty and for administration and staff, but it's also new to accreditors. It's new to the department. And the department's learning as it goes, but it has a process that has taken many, many months, and I think Aaron can speak to that better than I can. But at the same time, I would say that there's great hope here because the department currently has applications that it's reviewing for schools to engage in experimental sites that might allow us to get to a point where there's greater clarity for the accrediting commissions to make their decisions and perhaps even some added flexibility so that we can really figure out what the full potential is for competency-based education programs. So this is very much a work in process, Casey.
Aaron, you mentioned that Wisconsin's doing nursing. So it would seem to build on Mike's comments, it's not just three tiers of approval in terms of a regional accreditor, the federal review, and then also aid eligibility, but also in some instances the professional associations that certify programs. Are they coming around to the notion of competency the way the regionals are?
Yeah, and actually I would add an additional, which is state licensing boards as well. Yes, and the answer is yes. In principle, and in the discussions we've had, Mike knows this too because of the work he does nationally, all of the accreditors at every level recognize that competency-based or other kinds of alternative delivery models are here to stay, that they're a valid route to a degree. They can be done well or they can be done poorly, and their job is to help assure the quality. How to do it is where the challenge is, and since it's new ground, we are walking kind of hand in hand down the route, down the road with these different accreditors. Department of Ed, for example. Well, as Mike mentioned, our accreditor is HLC, and that process was fairly straightforward, and it required us having some initial discussion about what the model is and features and how it fit and quality standards, et cetera. And then we went back and forth, and they gave the approval. With the federal government, it was very much a similar process, but a much longer process because we were the first institution going through under a certain route of approval, which is called non-term direct assessment. Now that we've worked that out, and that took us about 8 months, we expect that to be a model for other institutions going through. There's a little bit of reassurance and some, gateposts of where programs need to be in order to demonstrate quality and changing the role of faculty, how that impacts student experience and all the rest of it. Again, it's been really interesting. Everyone recognizes where we need to be, and we're sorting out and figuring out together how to get there.
Scott, there's been a lot of pushback, as we've seen over the last several years, on the part of different parts of the corporate sector, the business community, saying college graduates are not well prepared. These are primarily graduates coming out of more conventional programs. Purdue president and former Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels, in talking about the competency-based program at his institution, actually said that students from his program, quote, will emerge with proven competencies. Business will not have to guess whether these students are ready for the market, ready for their businesses, ready for the world. As you track these issues about students going into the labor force, you know, will students with competency-based programs have an edge, or will they be at a disadvantage, stigmatized because they're not from a credit-based program? Where's that going? What's the prospect there?
To be honest, I don't think most employers will know the term competency-based education. They're probably more likely to identify students with the reputations of their institutions, fair or unfair, or to have hired previously from a given institution and have a feel about the place. It's important to note much of the interest in competency-based education is coming from older students who are already employed and looking to upgrade. But I think time will really tell. We have long had some fields like nursing, which we talked about earlier, where graduates take a licensure exam or must pass some sort of system that, in fact, is competency already. On employer acceptance, I think the addition of these big-name universities will help, but it's going to be where we are 5 years from now. Do they think it mattered? Do they notice a change? They might notice a positive change. So I think it's probably too early to say.
Aaron Brower from the University of Wisconsin, Mike Offerman, President Emeritus of Capella, and Scott Jasek, thank you for the conversation about competency. Too, our thanks to Dan Hurley from Askew, Christopher Loss from Vanderbilt for joining us for the earlier segment on After the Elections. And our thanks, too, to you, our audience, for joining us this week. This week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or podcast early afternoons on most Fridays. On the web, we're available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Please share your thoughts about this week with us on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you all.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times. Thank you.